Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, and discuss the austerity trap that the economy is stuck in, with political gridlock and election politics digging the hole deeper. However, there is some reason to hope that as the powerful and privileged 1% try to take us back to the Gilded Age, a movement forming might rally the nation to reclaim the American dream for the 99%. Then we will look into the shameful growth of student debt that will reach $1 trillion this year. David Halperin, who is the Director of Campus Progress at the Center for American Progress, joins us to explain the increasing debt load students are now burdened with as they face a shrinking job market, and how lobbyists for the for-profit college industry have managed to get Congress to have taxpayer money charged back to unwitting students at exorbitant rates for a worthless education and a useless diploma. Then finally, we'll talk about drone warfare and the inevitable blowback that will come as the U.S. loses its technological edge and other nations develop their own drones. David Courtwright, the Director of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame University, joins us to discuss the future implications of the proliferation of remote-controlled killing machines. Joining us now is Robert Reich, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, and his latest book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Reich.
Hello, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And I don't know whether you watched the Republican debate. I know you wrote about it and how much free airtime they're getting and they're also getting quite a lot of viewers. But I must say it's beginning to look a bit like a kind of reality show like the Jersey Housewives. You know, you've got the pizza man throwing out all these zany ideas, and Ron Paul is like the crazy old uncle that everybody's trying to shut him up. But what I find most disturbing, though, is the audiences. They booed a gay veteran. They cheered at the prospect of pulling the plug on someone without health insurance. And then they cheered Herman Cain, who blamed the unemployed for being out of work.
Well, this all goes back to social Darwinism of the late 19th century, and that's where a lot of the Republicans want to take us back to, the era where the notion was survival of the fittest. You don't help anybody in need, so they said at the time, because that will just make them even lazier. The rich need to have more rewards so that they will work even harder, and the poor and needy need to have fewer rewards so they will perish, and so that the nation will be stronger. And that's essentially social Darwinism, and that's really what many of the Republicans are preaching and what some of their followers believe.
So does this explain why our culture is getting crueler and coarser?
Well, not everybody in the culture, in the society, agrees with social Darwinism, Ian. I think it's a very small portion of the public. I mean, the Tea Partiers, to the extent that they agree with it, are a very tiny portion of the American public. I think most people understand that we all rise or fall together, that we have to pull together if we're going to get through anything, whether it's Second World War or the Cold War or a economic depression or an economic recession. We are very good at rolling up our sleeves and working together. And I think this is what the Occupy Wall Street and the other Occupy LA and other Occupy centers are trying to put forward, a vision that we're just not a bunch of individuals premised on social Darwinism. We're actually linked together, and we need each other, and we have responsibilities toward one another.
And Robert Reich, the Occupy Wall Street, which is now spread across the country, and we have Occupy Los Angeles, you have Occupy Oakland up near you, and it's also spread around the world. It seems that the 99% versus the 1% is actually, I think, proving to be a very, very powerful unifying message. What's your sense, though, of the movement? Because it seems to me, as long as it deals with economic issues, it's grows and it's bound to be more and more powerful, and it already has a lot of public support, several times more than the Tea Party does. But being on the left, there's a fear that it may get you know, sort of diffused by identity politics and other extraneous political issues. What's your analysis of that?
Ian, inevitably there's going to be some of that. I don't know where the occupier movement is going. I don't think anybody does, even in the so-called movement. In fact, I'm not even sure it's a movement yet. It could be. It needs probably the next stage will be more discipline and a little bit more specificity, not too specific. But I've already sensed a change in the tenor of public debate as a result of the Occupy Wall Street movement. That is, in fact, I was just in Washington last week, and I, in a lot of conversations, you know, Washington is just a series of meetings, basically, but several times, Democrats and even some Republicans brought up the question of inequality and concentration of income and wealth in various conversations. Now, that would never have been brought up without the occupier movement having made it an issue, a broad issue, even though it's not very specific and the demands are not very well articulated or articulated at all. But even the issue is now ripe in a way that it wasn't ripe 5 or 6 weeks ago.
So in terms of the 1% versus the 99%, do you think that that we are at a changing point? Because for a while there, it felt like that some of the traditional virtues of, you know, that go back to the pioneering days of shared sacrifice and neighborliness, I can't even pronounce the word, neighborliness, et cetera, seem to have been replaced by, you know, maybe it goes back to Ayn Rand, the idea that altruism is terrible and selfishness is a virtue. But I sense that there's something changing in the zeitgeist here about.
Well, I think what's changed is Americans are hurting. Most people are, you know, sense that the dice are loaded. The game is rigged in some way. I mean, how is it that the top executives of the biggest corporations and the top executives of Wall Street, whose depredations have brought on much of the disaster that we're still living through, how can they be doing so well? Why is it that we bailed out Wall Street taxpayers, and yet we didn't bail out or help a lot of the people who desperately need help? Why is it that we can't even raise taxes, even slightly, on people who are at the top, who've never taken home, at least in 80 years, such a large portion of national income and wealth, and who face now the lowest tax rates than they faced since the 1980s, since Ronald Reagan? Why, you know, the reason, the answer for all of that has to do with the fact that power goes with wealth and income. And I think that the progressive urge in America, the progressive ideal, is insulted by what is going on. I think that the Occupy movement is a response to this lurch toward something that is very un-American and that most people are very uncomfortable about.
So do you think that in a way this not so much the Wall Street movement, but the Wall Street itself in terms of the way it has created this illusion of talent and reward, and we know that they took us to the brink of economic collapse, and yet subsequently after the taxpayers bailed them out, they've rewarded themselves and the bonuses keep going. But there's a culture out there in corporate America amongst CEOs, and you point out in your recent writing that CEOs in the 1970s were paid 40 times the average worker's wage, and now they receive 300 times a typical worker's wage. And there's a very disturbing book called Retirement Heist by Ellen Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning veteran reporter from the Wall Street Journal. Really analyzing with absolute clarity that what's been going on in this country is that corporate America has literally been stealing the pension money from the workers and essentially handing it over to executives.
Ian, it's been going on for quite some time now. I mean, for at least two or three decades, this growing arrogance on Wall Street and in top corporate suites. I mean, the Bank of America hit by a credit downgrade last month, has just moved its risky derivatives from its Merrill Lynch unit to a subsidiary that's flush with insured deposits of you and me and other people. I mean, this continues to go on, these kind of shenanigans. And I think, quite honestly, most Americans are fed up with it. They're fed up with the unequal power. They're fed up with the dice being loaded against them. They're fed up with a system that is not designed any longer to respond to the needs of ordinary people, and a democracy that is a democracy, unfortunately, more and more in name only, that is dominated by money and money coming from very powerful moneyed interests. The occupiers have tapped into something that is very, very large and very deep right now. And every time in this country we have been challenged profoundly by a sense that the economy and our democracy are in jeopardy, whether we're talking about the progressive era between 1900 and 1916, or we're talking about the New Deal, or what happened in the 1960s, the Great Society, and so forth, or we're talking about more recently, I mean, even the environmental movement. What happens is Americans get together, and they allow common sense to prevail. They don't want these radical right-wing Ayn Rand ideas to dominate. That's not America.
Well, America, a lot of our mythology is about a meritocracy, and that's the part of it that I find extraordinary, is that somehow these people in this rarefied atmosphere of the top corporate suites in this country have created this illusion that they have peculiar talents and that they can go from one day they can manage a pineapple canning factory and the next day they can buy an aerospace company or be head of CEO of an aerospace company. And just recently up near where you are, Robert Reich, the HP, Hewlett Packard, hired a guy, gave him a $10 million signing bonus. He only lasted 10 months, I think, as the CEO. And then they gave him another $10 million to go out the door. And in order to pay for all of these packages that they threw at this guy that they were essentially firing, I think they had to lay off like 1,400 workers.
Well, not only do people lose their jobs, but consumers pay more. Small investors don't get the returns that small investors need for their pension plans. The more we have the game rigged toward people at the top, where more and more of the income and wealth moves to the top, the more everybody else just doesn't get forward. I mean, we're seeing median wages now declining rapidly. Incomes, family incomes are going down. And here's the thing that really, when I looked at the data, I was struck. Ian, 37% of all families with young children in the United States are now in poverty. 37%. That's the highest record level of poverty among families with children, with young children. 37%. I mean, here we're living in a society now, the richest society we have had ever. I mean, America is vastly rich, but we have the top 1% now taking home over 20% of total national income. We have the top 1% taking home and sitting on 35% of the total wealth of the nation. Let me just give you one further data point. I know the data eyes glaze over, but these are such powerful realities. The 400 wealthiest families in America are now sitting on more wealth and have more wealth than the bottom 150 million people in the United States. I mean, things are so skewed, bizarrely skewed, and the power that is now centralized in people like the Koch brothers or people who are abusing that power to manipulate our political process. Well, this just can't go on. And I think most Americans, they don't have to be lefty or right wing. They don't have to have a political identification or an ideology. They just look at this and they say, this is insane. This is not the America I know any longer. I can't in good conscience sit back and do nothing about it. I've got to be active. I've got to, if nothing else, I've got to demonstrate. And that's exactly what's beginning to happen.
Well, Robert Reich, we seem to be marooned in a peculiar netherworld between economic realities that are dire and political possibilities that are dismal. And you have written in your latest piece, The Austerity Death Trap, indicating that we actually may, that hole may be being dug further, because if the Republicans don't agree to a budget deal before the end of the year, and, you know, records indicate that that's highly likely that they won't, the temporary payroll tax cuts and extended unemployment benefits we have now will end. And with these ongoing cuts of state and local government at every level, this fiscal contraction, we've seen it happen in the UK, the writing is on the wall. So as we shrink our economy, as we shrink demand even further, because the real issue is to create demand, it's not, you know, the corporate America may be sitting on tons of money, but there's nobody going to the malls to buy anything. So we seem to be in this situation where as the economy shrinks, then the debt that everybody seems to be so concerned about, it gets worse.
Yeah, I mean, we find ourselves in a vicious cycle. If people don't have enough money to buy things because they're worried about their jobs and their wages, then companies can't expand. In fact, companies actually have to go abroad. But even the foreign markets are beginning to shrink. China, demand in China is shrinking, and also Europe is in its own debt crisis, and Japan, of course, is flat on its back. So you have an entire global economy that is in the throes of a kind of austerity trap. And we in the United States, of all places, know, and we have followed the basic rule for years, that if people don't have enough money to work, if they are not paid a decent salary, they can't turn around and keep the economy going. And so when so much income and wealth goes to the top, Ian, and we're now seeing the results, when so much income and wealth goes to the top, then the vast middle class and working class and poor of America don't have the purchasing power to keep the economy going on their own, without going deep and deeper and deeper into debt, and of course that's not sustainable. So you see, this system that we have right now is itself not sustainable. Not only in environmental terms, it's not sustainable even in economic terms. People at the very top, the very rich, would be better off with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than they are with a very large share of an economy that's dead in the water. Now, when are they going to realize it? Well, I don't think they're going to realize it on their own. That's why I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic about the occupier movement. I'm optimistic about the common sense of Americans. We have an election coming up. I think that people are waking up.
Well, indeed, the trap that Spain's in, where the unemployment, 44 out of 100 young Spaniards are out of work. Little wonder they formed these encampments, which in many ways became the inspiration for the Occupy Wall Street movement. And you're suggesting in your recent writing that whenever privilege and power conspire to pull us backwards, the nation eventually rallies and moves forward. And I take it that that the sense is that this 99% movement may be what's kickstarting a new movement. Now,
it may be, Ian. We just don't know. I think that it's already had the effect, as I said before, of changing the tenor of debate a little bit in Washington, which means that, you know, Washington, although it's an echo chamber, it's a bubble, it does pay attention when a lot of Americans begin marching or demonstrating or when something seems to be happening and spreading. And so Washington is listening. Washington is watching. And that itself is a huge victory.
Thank you so much for joining us.
So I will talk to you soon, I hope.
You certainly will. Thank you.
Okay.
And so just speaking then with Robert Reich, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California in Berkeley. He served in three national administrations, most recently Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. His latest book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.
Giving us a squeeze. us against them. We found our own reasons to sing, and it's so much less confusing when lines are drawn like that. When people are either consumers or revolutionaries, enemies or friends, hanging on the fringes of the cogs in the system. It's just about knowing where everyone stands. All of a sudden, people start talking about guns.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, who is the Director of Campus Progress at the Center for American Progress. Campus Progress is devoted to supporting progressive activists and student journalists on college campuses. David Halperin is a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton and Howard Dean. He's also worked as an attorney and consultant for such groups as Public Citizen, Greenpeace, and Democracy for America. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be back.
So we now learn that the student debt in this country may top $1 trillion this year. Obviously, there is a connection here to many of the young people who are demonstrating across this country and around the world, in part started by the Occupy Wall Street movement. I've interviewed some people down here at Occupy Los Angeles. Some students, the first thing they talk about was the onerous debt burden they have. Do you see this as a growing political issue?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. This year, Americans will take out more than $100 billion in student loans, which is a record. And as you mentioned, the total debt owned by students may be more than $1 trillion. And it's starting to look a little bit like the mortgage crisis, and I hope it doesn't get to that level. But the problem is, I would say four factors here. You've got higher educational costs going up, and I can tell you how much. We can get into that. Less financial aid than there was in the past. Bad educational value in many cases, especially with for-profit colleges as their growth has increased. And, of course, high unemployment. So more people are paying more money to get an education and then finding that they have debt and no jobs and therefore they can't pay back the loan. So it's very tough, and we've been hearing it. It's been 7 years we've been building Campus Progress, and I think it's getting to the point that it is becoming part of what is making people angry and concerned about the future of the country.
So, I'm speaking with David Halperin, who is the Director of Campus Progress at the Center for American Progress, and we're talking about how student loan debt in the United States will top $1 trillion this year. And the for-profit colleges, we've talked about them before, and I must say I find them just absolutely unconscionable that in this environment where you have this enormous debt load the students have, and we've discussed why, in part because of higher tuition costs. But what is, I think, unconscionable is that government money is being loaned back to students at huge premiums to buy these for-profit colleges that in turn provide a next to useless education and a worthless diploma. And that just seems cruel to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to say they're not all worthless. I know people that teach at some of these institutions and do well, but many of them are worthless, and many of them are just basically scams. They have 10% of the students in the U.S., which is much more than they used to have. They have 25% of the financial aid. They have 46% of the loan defaults. If you go to a for-profit school, you're twice as likely to end up in default as if you went to a nonprofit or a public institution of higher learning. And many of them are just straight up scams. All they want to do is get you in the door. Many get 90% of their revenue from federal financial aid, and they would get more, except there's a law that says you can't get more than 90% of your revenue from federal financial aid. So they're right up against that limit. A lot of them, once they get your money, and you get past the date when they don't have to give back the money, they lose interest in you. Many of them, just the programs are just a joke, and we talk to a lot of the students who go to them. But what's worse and what's more offensive is, as you know, we discussed another time, and hopefully all your listeners were tuned in both times, they, when they were faced with the government saying, look, you've got to do better. If your students are flunking out at high rates, if your students can't pay back their loans at high rates, then you're not going to be able to get this financial aid anymore. What they did, instead of saying, okay, you know, our reign of terror and excess is over, they hired every lobbyist in Washington, D.C., many, many prominent Democrats, to lobby this Democratic administration to try to gut this regulation. And they succeeded to some extent, although because there was a year of debate on this bill and on this regulation and whether they should be held accountable, the media caught up, the public caught up, students spoke out, and now their fortunes are changing, and their enrollment is down, their stock is down, and they're going to have to change, and they won't unless we remain vigilant. But for-profit colleges, while serving some people well, have ruined a lot of lives and are a big part of this picture of why we're getting to $1 trillion worth of student debt and a real risk of a big student loan default crisis that will really affect our whole economy.
Well, it just seems to be particularly egregious that that this is federal money, in that, and a lot of these colleges, I believe, prey on veterans, don't they? Come right out of the service and sign up.
They do, and you know, it's veterans represent a group of people that, you know, deserve our gratitude for what they've been willing to do, whether we agreed with these wars or not. They put themselves on the line, you know, and they've been carrying the burden of these wars when most Americans, you know, don't really feel it. And then the idea that there would be a federal program that, you know, helped aid and abet putting these veterans deeper in debt, and then that lobbyists would come up and defend these programs, it's a national shame. And it's not, you know, in veterans, it's low-income people, it's people of color, it's young people, but it's also older people that are trying to, you know, have a new start in their lives. So this, quite apart, almost distinct from this national debt crisis, just the whole idea of luring people in with not just poor quality education, but terrible recruiting practices where people are lied to, people are manipulated. I mean, there is military recruiting where some people say, you know, that again, that crosses over into taking advantage of vulnerable people. But the military itself, while, you know, obviously putting people at risk who join it, is legitimate operation. And sometimes these for-profit schools use worse tactics and bring people into something that is not legitimate in any way.
Well, my understanding is that these payday loan operations were setting up all around big military bases and getting not just soldiers in debt, but while they were serving abroad, they'd get their families in deeper in debt. Mm-hmm. And I believe that there was hearings in Congress, and that they cracked down on these payday loan operations that were literally around, you know, Fort Bragg and these other big military bases, and so I'm surprised that similar outrage hasn't been expressed with these predatory student loans. But I guess the answer is that they've got an effective lobby, right?
They have really good lobbyists. You know, one force is going to be the Consumer Financial Protection Board, which was built by Elizabeth Warren for President Obama, and she's obviously moved on to another pursuit. But they have hired Holly Petraeus to specialize in these veterans issues and to protect veterans. They have another division that's going to work on students. They don't have jurisdiction over the federal loans, but they do over the private educational loans of the kind that you mentioned. So hopefully that agency will become a force for positive change on these issues, and that people in Congress will be looking out for this stuff. And look, we, you know, we don't want to be too paternalistic in America. We don't want to say, you know, poor people can't buy houses, can't take on loans. So we don't want to be in a situation where we say, you know, these people are just too risky and they're victims, and therefore they shouldn't have anything. They're entitled to their dignity, and they're entitled to make decisions. But it's the imbalance of information that people receive, and it's the false information that people receive. And, you know, a simple thing like, I could get a low interest loan that I wouldn't have to pay back till I graduate. I'm eligible for that federally guaranteed loan.
but I don't get it because no one told me about it, and so I get a high interest loan that starts. I have to start paying back immediately. Stuff like that is just unconscionable. And the problem is, frankly, there's a lot in our economy that's driven by scams. Scams on Wall Street, scams in things like payday lending that you mentioned, rent to own, and for-profit
right.
colleges.
Right.
And what's worse than people getting scammed is that then educated people I served with in the Clinton administration, people leaving the Obama administration, are then paid to go to Congress and say with a straight face, you know, this isn't a scam. It's a wonderful thing for America. It's, you know, fool me once, shame on me, shame on you, but fool me twice. And the problem is Americans are getting fooled twice by fancy lobbyists who defend these scams as legitimate. And that's, I think people are starting to see through all this garbage, and that's why you're seeing outrage. That's why you're seeing the Occupy movement. That's why you're seeing more activism. That's why I'm glad I've been lucky to run Campus Progress for 7 years and work with young people who are, you know, who don't just blame others for their problems, but step up and try to look for solutions to them.
So what is happening, David Halpern, in terms of some kind of legislative action to stop these scam artists? So the protest movement is getting attention, but it doesn't necessarily have a political agenda. They're forming an agenda with these General Assembly meetings, etc. But I'm just wondering about what, from your position there in Washington, who's taking on the fight on behalf of these students that have $1 trillion of debt on their shoulders?
Well, here in Washington, you know, there's been a coalition building to support access to education. That includes a lot of great organizations like the Institute for College Access and Success, the Education Trust, the United States Student Association, Student Perks, Campus Progress. And when it comes to this issue of for-profit colleges, we were able to build an enormous coalition of groups and individuals who were ready to speak out. And that included some large unions like the AFL-CIO, like the NCLR, La Raza, the NAACP, the Leadership Conference for Civil and Human Rights. These organizations realize that these are issues that affect, you know, a lot of people, that they're consumer issues, that they're really issues of justice and fairness. And so we were able to come together. But we, you know, it's hard to match the firepower of the lobbyists. And, you know, frankly, right after a key vote on this issue in the House, the industry held a fundraiser. They don't even wait, you know, these days, a day or two. They go right to the fundraiser to say, thank you for, you know, supporting us. And we can't match that. We would never match that graft. All we have is people. But getting more people at the grassroots connected to these issues so that they're not just a bunch of Washington people like me, you know, trying to use our powers of persuasion and creativity. And we have the facts on our side, but it's not enough. You need people power to do this. And that's why movements like this and more efforts to get people plugged in on these issues is the only way we're going to win. If all of this stuff was put to a vote and everybody had time, you know, 40 hours a day, and didn't have to work, and we could all vote on this, then progressives would win on all of these issues because the facts are on our side and the population is on our side. The problem is the money's on the other side, and the money allows the few to prevail, and it takes a lot of outrage and a lot of energy for people to overcome that.
But just to do a reality check here at the close here, David Halpern, the money is on their side, but it's federal money. It's taxpayer money. Saying that's the part that I find extraordinary is that that Congress has allowed these people to take federal money and to charge it back and make enormous profits out of it. And then presumably the money which they lobby the Congress with is also taxpayer money.
It takes money to make money, and that's what they do. And that's right. It is an outrage. Their lobbyists are paid basically by federal money to lobby to keep on getting federal money that is being wasted and worse than being wasted. We'd be better off with a lot of that money if they just threw it in the river or in the ocean than if they gave it to people to 10 programs that waste their time, waste their own money, and wreck their lives. And so it is, I mean, there are a few worse outrages than some of the federal, you know, the ways that people are ripping off the federal government and then hiring lobbyists to defend it. If you're going to defend a Wall Street scam, of course, that's also cost federal money when we have to bail these firms out. Same thing. They go on and act recklessly with their money and with their investors' money. Then they go broke, then or get close to going broke. Then they ask for a federal bailout. And then 2 years later, they use resources to hire lobbyists to say, gee, you know, there's too much federal regulation, and that's what's curbing, you know, our progress, is Wall Street shouldn't have, you know, shouldn't be so shackled. Of course, some of these for-profit colleges are owned by Wall Street firms. So it's one thing if you say free market all the way. It's another thing if you're living off an industry like for-profit colleges where 90% of the money is from federal taxpayers, and then when you get called for being scam artists, you just take some of that money, you hire lobbyists, and you defend your position. You know, people ought to be angry. People ought to be protesting, because and that should be true whether you consider yourself a progressive, conservative, pragmatic, moderate. Ripping off people with federal money is one of the worst things you can do, and that's what they're doing. And that's why we're in the student debt crisis that started this discussion.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, David Halpern.
Ian Masters, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who is the director of the Campus Progress at the Center for American Progress. Campus Progress is devoted to supporting progressive activists and student journalists on college campuses. David Halpern is a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton and Howard Dean. He's also worked as an attorney and consultant for such groups as Public Citizen, Greenpeace, and Democracy in America. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
We walk the 40 blocks to the middle of the place we heard that everything would be. And there were barricades to keep us off the street. But the crowd kept pushing forward till they swallowed the police. Yeah, they went.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Courtwright, an American scholar and peace activist. He is the director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame and chair of the board of Fourth Freedom Forum. In 1978, he was named the executive director of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, which under his direction became the largest disarmament organization in the United States. Thereafter, he initiated the merger of SANE and the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign and served for a time as co-director of the merged organization. In 2002, he helped to found the Win Without War Coalition in opposition to the United States invasion of Iraq. His most recent books are Towards Nuclear Zero and Peace, A History of Movements and Ideas. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Courtwright.
Thank you, Ian.
And the drone issue has become quite central to the anti-war movement, and people feel very passionately about it in terms of obviously, you know, real moral issues are being raised. What is your understanding of what it is about the drones and the use of drones that people find so offensive? Because, you know, clearly, in the overall scheme of war, it's all pretty offensive, you know?
Right, but this is basically a policy of targeted killing. It's assassination of people by our government, and we're acting without any basis in law against those who we claim to be our enemies in countries like Pakistan or Yemen, where we have never had any formal declaration of military hostilities. In fact, Pakistan is supposed to be our ally, and we're giving them probably $2 billion a year in military and other kinds of assistance. So it's a policy that is completely without any basis in law. Maybe in Afghanistan, arguably because of the congressional authorization for military force, there might be an argument. But in these other places, not at all. And who is to judge who might be worthy of being attacked by our American forces? There's no court of law. These attacks outside Afghanistan are being managed by the CIA, an organization notorious for having committed many crimes in the past and also for being disastrously wrong in many of its previous supposed intelligence operations. So many troubling moral and political issues are raised by this. You know, how can we as a nation be engaged in this policy of targeted killing and assassination around the world? And what happens as other nations begin to acquire this technology, as inevitably they will, and in fact already dozens of nations are either building them or purchasing them?
Again, I'm speaking with David Courtwright, American scholar and peace activist. He's the director of the of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame and chair of the board of Fourth Freedom Forum. And we're talking about the prospect of a global drone warfare in a sense, blowback, since the U.S. developed drones, and it appears to be the weapon of choice, particularly in Afghanistan and inside of Pakistan as well, and in Yemen. Inevitably, this monopoly will not last, and we're talking about how soon that things will change. Now, meanwhile, the program itself, of course, the Air Force apparently initially resisted the drone program. It started with the CIA, and they were the first to put these Hellfire missiles on the Predator drones, which were designed for surveillance, but then they found a way that they could have an offensive capability, and that's obviously grown. I believe there's a new generation of Predators that are much bigger, longer range, and have more firepower. But all along, apparently, the Air Force has resisted the drones program, but apparently former Secretary of Defense Gates was the one who pushed it through. And now you have this peculiar thing where, because the reason the Air Force didn't like it was that it's pilotless, you know, and there's the pilot lobby within the Air Force lobby, and they apparently have been fairly vocal. But now they seem to have come to some bizarre compromise where highly trained American pilots for, you know, flying these new generation aircraft at, you know, enormous taxpayer investment in their training sit at consoles now, and with a little toggle switch and fly these drones over Pakistan. Does that strike you as being a bit peculiar?
It is. It's weird, and it's rather frightening, I think. And I read recently that there are actually more drone, quote, pilots being trained than regular flying pilots. But yes, to think of it, that our new pilots, as they're being called, are based in a set of computers somewhere in a base, and they're looking at screens and killing people thousands of miles away, and then they're leaving the office and going home and, you know, taking the kids to their soccer match or whatever, and it's very bizarre. We're separating the soldiers, in this case the pilots, those who are engaged in military action, we're separating them from the consequences of the actual killing that goes on in war. And that's always a morally troubling development. And because they're so separated, they have, of course, no risk. They're just there at the base in front of these screens all day. So their lives are never put at risk. And that's why Secretary Gates and now Panetta have been praising these weapons. And they appear to make war less costly. It's sort of war on the cheap. And any activity that makes war seem less costly inevitably makes war potentially more likely. It sort of lowers the moral threshold. It lowers the political bar for president who might want to engage in military action. They don't have to worry about the backlash that would come from our citizens over our pilots and our soldiers being killed in war. Now we are under the illusion that we can kill without incurring any costs to ourselves. And that's, I think, a very dangerous development that will certainly in the future make war more likely, if not by our own leaders, then by others.
Well, apparently, though, there's a new generation of drones being developed by military planners that they're autonomous, so that the drone itself makes the decisions to fire.
Yeah, it's called smart technology, yeah. I mean, this is under consideration, and there is some technological development, some experimentation underway on this. They haven't made the decision yet, but yes, this is because one of the problems they're finding is that there is some time lag between when the pilots on their monitors are certain that the target is in a particular location, and then from that time until they send the signal to the aircraft and the missile is launched. So the military planners want to have a quicker response time, and the only way to do that is to give the aircraft itself the capability of deciding that this is the target, yes, and then firing the missile. So we potentially have machines. This development will be probably a decade or more in the future, but potentially machines that would be making the decision to kill humans.
So, David Courtright, the drone war began in Pakistan in 2004. And apparently there have been about 2,000 people being killed in these drone strikes since then. What's your understanding of the ratio of so-called bad guys, I guess they call them, or high-value targets or whatever, and the collateral damage, which would be civilians and families of, you know, of the people that they're killing?
Yeah, the so-called collateral damage issue. Whenever you're firing weapons into houses or cars, or you're inevitably going to kill innocent people. Civilians will die. And in this case, in terms of the Pakistan war, we really have no way of knowing precisely, because who's giving the information? Well, mostly it's from the CIA and from military intelligence. We also hear from the other side, from the militants and the Taliban who are targeted, you know, inflated figures. In fact, at one point, the counterterrorism chief at the White House, Brennan, claimed, I think it was in June of this year, he claimed that there were no civilians killed over the previous year by our drone attacks. Well, they quickly backed off of that outlandish claim. But how many civilians have been killed, we don't know. There is an organization in UK, the Investigative Bureau, Investigative Bureau, I forget the full title, and they've been investigating, and their methodology is to take all of the news accounts of each particular incident, the news accounts that come from the U.S. and the West, and also those from the people on the ground in Pakistan, and try to look at the numbers and evaluate which is the most accurate. And what they found is that there are civilian casualties documented in about 1 out of 5 attacks. And of the more than 2,000 who have died in these drone attacks since the war began in Pakistan, the number of civilians is estimated to be somewhere between 300 and 700. So it's a very wide range, which tells you we really don't know that much, but at least gives you some order of magnitude that maybe 1 out of 4, 1 out of 5 of the people who are being killed in these attacks are clearly civilians. But I think the number is higher because, you know, we call these people militants and terrorists. But what does that mean? You know, maybe they have taken up weapons in an insurgency in northern Pakistan that's also related to the insurgency in Afghanistan. Are they mortal enemies of the United States, or are they fighting for because they don't like the governments in Afghanistan, or they don't like American troops occupying Afghanistan as they see it? So what gives us the right to kill those kind of people, and can we say that they are terrorists or enemies of the United States? So how we define these categories is a tricky one. Also, we know that many of the people who have been taking up arms against either the Afghan government or our own troops, they're not necessarily trained fighters. They may be farmers during the day or working as mechanics during the day, but then at night they're out with the militant groups. They're guerrillas who are fighting this insurgent war. So how do we categorize them? They're certainly not uniformed military. So this is very tricky ground as well. It adds to the moral dilemmas in terms of how we define the targets, supposed targets, and are they truly dangerous and threatening to the United States, to international security in any way? If we look at it that way, then my guess is that many of those who are being killed are not truly threats to international security or to the United States.
Well, it would seem, David Courtright, that, I mean, there's just so many questions to ask here, and we don't know what the targeting protocols are. You know, the CIA have their program. The Air Force has its program. How far up the chain for authorization goes, what the flexibility is of those manning these controls, these remote controls, watching a television set. None of that we really have a clear picture on. We know that people are on the ground in the Waziristan and in Pakistan providing evidence. We know that from the attack on Massoud, the head of the Pakistan Taliban. Apparently somebody got his father-in-law to drop a dime on him, if you will. They bribed this guy a lot of money. And, of course, it turned out his own daughter was killed along with Massoud. She was giving him a massage apparently at the time that the missile struck. So it's very sort of odd that you got people on the ground, but you need this thing, this high-tech thing, to do the actual job. But the other thing that bothers me is that since these new military industrial complex companies are dealing with drones, and I don't know which of the contractors have the have stolen a march on the technology, but I don't know what restraints are on them in terms of foreign sales. You say the Brits and the Israelis are also in the business, and probably not too far behind the United States.
Well, and it is a business, because if you go on the internet, you can find drones for rent or for hire, so to speak. So, and we know in the military contracting business that we see very rampant in Afghanistan and Iraq, there are very few controls, if any. Military contracting is very much a monopoly, sweetheart kind of business, where relationships are based on connections that are made, and there's no very little accountability, a great deal of corruption. So this is the other side of it. The industrial side is going to be pushing this to develop more and more of these weapons. They obviously have this self-interest, and we've seen in many other cases where weapons are built largely at the impetus of contractors who have very cozy connections with not only the Pentagon, but also with the members of Congress. You know, there's now a drone caucus in the U.S. Congress. There are dozens of members of Congress, probably those who have contractors or subcontractors in their districts who stand to make money on this business.
Well, but you just mentioned, David Courtright, that there are companies who can hire drones. I mean, what kind of restrictions are on that, and what would the purpose of hiring a drone be?
These are surveillance ones right now.
Right, but I mean,
yeah, I don't know.
I mean, could an estranged husband hire a drone to fly over his ex-wife's house or something? I mean,
yeah, one wonders, right?
I mean, the other thing that, just in closing, David Courtright, the one thing that I wonder about is as bad as the military situation is, and as murky as the whole picture is that you're giving us here today, I wonder, in terms of law enforcement, how long before the LAPD is flying drones over South Central Los Angeles, for example.
No, it's bound to happen with this technology spreading, and I'd be surprised if it's not already out there. Hopefully, you know, if that were to happen, maybe it would alert Americans to the threat that these systems pose, and we might get some action to put some controls on them. But it's just absolutely necessary that these things be brought under some form of public control, some accountability. And certainly, we need to get the CIA out of this business. I mean, this is a historically new and very dangerous development that the CIA is actively involved in military operations. And now we know in the bad old days that they've been doing these covert operations all around the world since the end of the Cold War, and that's bad enough. But now they've been given a formal military role in conducting combat operations through this technology and relying on supposed sources to spot who the targets are to be in these places like Waziristan and northern Pakistan. Who are the people that they're relying on, and are they truly legitimate sources of information? Maybe they have their own political agendas or grudges that they're trying to even up and getting the United States to fall into that trap. We've seen a lot of this did occur in Iraq, probably is occurring in Afghanistan and Pakistan as well. So this is another aspect of the danger that's being developed here through the use of these drones and the assigning of the CIA of all organizations in the world that we would least want to have managing such a program. Here it is.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, David Courtwright.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Courtwright, an American scholar and peace activist. He's the director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and he's the chair of the board of the Fourth Freedom Forum. His most recent books are Towards Nuclear Zero and Peace, A History of Movements and Ideas. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. And this program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.